I'm your host, Chris Holmes, professor of literature at Ithaca College. We have a wonderful show for you this week. One of my favorite authors, Dana Spiota, is here to talk about her newest novel, Wayward, the story of Sam, who upends her life to live in a house in which she might claim something like autonomy over her body, her choices, and her way of living in a world on fire. Like all of Spiota's fiction, no character comes to us as uncomplicated or easily dismissed as good or bad, and her language play works through us like a magic, offering both a propelling narrative force and the beauty of the unexpected. Wayward is also one of the best books I've ever read about the nature of motherhood, and the sacrifices, worthy and otherwise, that mothers of all kinds are called upon to make. If you're looking for the read that will stay with you through the last gasps of summer, Wayward is your book. I hope you enjoy my interview with Dana Spiota. Let's start the show. It's my pleasure today to welcome Dana Spiota. Dana is the author of five novels, Innocence and Others, winner of the St. Francis College Literary Prize and finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, Stone Arabia, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, Eat the Document, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and the winner of the American Academy's Rosenthal Foundation Award, and Lightning Field, a New York Times notable book. And most recently, of the much-acclaimed Wayward. She has held a Guggenheim Fellowship, a New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship, and the Rome Prize in Literature, among many such prestigious fellowships and awards. She is Associate Professor of English and on the faculty in the Creative Writing Program at Syracuse University. I'm very pleased to get a chance to speak with her today about Wayward, her meditation on the middle stages of a woman's life and the ways in which we go astray from the narrow paths that life lays out before us. Wayward takes up the story of Samantha Raymond, called Sam, an early 50s wife and mother who works at the Loomis House, a historical center devoted to the life of a 19th century female doctor, abortion advocate, and sometimes eugenicist. But it begins as a story about a house. Sam buys an arts and crafts home, historically significant and a wreck. As she puts it, the house was falling apart. The house was beautiful. Unbeknownst to her husband, Mark, and daughter, Allie, Sam plans to leave their family home to live in the beautiful ruins of this house in the urban wilds of Syracuse. The house works beautifully as a grand metaphor for Sam's own body, in decay, a keeper of history and lives lived, a storehouse of birth and death. Beautiful in its original fixtures, but leaky, letting in cold drafts and holding the humidity and desperate heat of summer. If this is the wayward path, then Sam is embracing it. She looks everywhere for examples of middle-aged women living comfortably in their bodies, embracing the changes and finding new kinds of strength, new desires that make them whole. Mostly, what she finds is the same kind of yearning for confidence and a purpose in a society that devalues the historical in every form, house and body. Wayward is also the story of motherhood and the problem of all-encompassing love for children. Allie, a smart and driven teenager with a penchant for tracking the etymologies of interesting words, is both the burning core of Sam's emotional life and an unknowable satellite, existing forever at a distance from her, refusing to be fully seen. The push and pull of mother and daughter becomes more complicated when the novel gives Allie the narrative voice, and we learn that the nerdy daughter has taken up with her mentor and teacher, Joe, in a relationship that is technically illegal and would, Allie believes, cause her mother to explode in flames. The struggle is then between two women, both desiring of autonomy and privacy while desperately needing one another. When Sam's wayward turn seems increasingly like a mistake, Spiota has other voices join the mother and daughter. Clara Loomis's letters as a young, defiant 19th century woman. Syracuse herself speaks through Sam's writing. And even Sam's own blood gets a chapter of its own to mark the body as fragile and necessary. The result is a novel of uncommon honesty about aging, motherhood, and the attachments with others we both crave and abhor. It is an ode to complicated cities with hidden histories, and to women who seek to know themselves fully, as beautiful, useful, meaningful, even when American society tells them otherwise. Wayward feels like a needed novel for our moment and a clarion call for us to embrace our wayward paths. It was a pleasure to live inside its world. Welcome to the show, Dana Spiota.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Would you begin for us by reading a section from the beginning? It's section 2 of the novel.
Yes. The house sat high on a tiny lot on Highland Street, which ran atop a hill that bordered a lawn expanse of grass and trees. It looked like a small sloping park, but it was actually a cemetery, the old graves scattered across the rise. Unless you were squeamish about graves, Sam wasn't. The sloping green hill was quite pretty. Highland itself offered a wide view of downtown. You could see the steeples of churches, and you could see how the small city was in a valley surrounded by hills. You could even see the kidney shape of Onondaga Lake, although it was often partly obscured by low-hanging clouds. If you turned your head to the left, or if you looked out the side windows of the house, you could see Syracuse University up on another hill. You could locate it by the quilted low white bubble of the Carrier Dome, named for the nearly absent Carrier Corporation. All that remained were a handful of jobs, the dome, and Carrier Circle, a treacherous traffic roundabout that Sam hated. Soon after you spotted the dome, you would notice the various spired and turreted campus buildings. The decision to leave her husband, the act of leaving really, began the moment she made an offer on the house. It was a Sunday. Sam woke up at 5 a.m., unable to continue sleeping. She attributed this unnecessarily early waking to the approach of menopause. Her period still came each month, but odd things had started changing in her body, even her brain, one of which was suddenly becoming awake at 5 a.m. on a Sunday, her mind shaking off sleep with unnegotiable clarity, as if she had already drunk a cup of coffee. And just as with coffee, she felt alert, an adrenal burst, but she could also feel the fatigue underneath it all, the weariness. That morning, the wood floor was cold against her bare feet, but she couldn't find her slippers. It was still dark. She tried not to wake her husband. She used her phone to illuminate the way to the bathroom. She peed, flushed, washed. She brushed her teeth without looking in the mirror. She pushed up the blinds to peek outside. The sky was gradually lightening with the dawn, and half a foot of snow had fallen overnight. It was one of those Syracuse March snow dumps. Everyone complained because it should be spring, but why say that when it was never spring in March in Syracuse? Besides, snow in March was often spectacular because of the spring light. The sunrise that was creeping up now cast a pink and gold glimmer, and a little crust of ice on top of the snow glittered from the sky and from the street lamps. The trees, the roofs of the houses, even the salt-crusted cars looked beautiful. And like most spectacularly beautiful effects, it was almost too much, too dramatic, nearly lurid. Sam loved the drama of a March snow. March meant the sky would be bright, blindingly bright, not the cloudy darkness of January or the dingy gray monotony of February, the worst month. But here was the important part. Sam figured that she was the only person on Earth who thought March snowstorms were wonderful, and this made her feel a bit proud of herself. Always she liked to imagine herself as subtly different from everyone else, enjoying the tension and mystique of being ordinary on the surface but with a radical, original interior life. For example, back when Sam used to shop the sales at the Talbots and DeWitt with the other suburban ladies of her class and age, she separated herself. Sure, Sam had discovered that the classic A-line or sheath dresses made of solid colored pont knits were so forgiving, so flattering, that tragic word, to a grotesque midlife misshapenness, a blurriness, a squareness, really. But despite being there and shopping because of an insider email blast notification of a super sale, Sam believed she was different from the other women. Inside, she was mocking the calibrated manipulations, mocking herself, noting the corporate branding and lifestyle implications of the preppy styles and colors, the classic plaids, the buttons on the sleeves, the ballerina flats, evoking a tastefully understated sensibility. It even occurred to her that the other women could be having the same interior thoughts, and the idea of conformity, at least in modern America, was never consciously sought after. You were allowed to keep a vain and precious sense of agency. Her sense of resistance was as manufactured as her need to buy flattering clothing. Nevertheless, Sam also believed that her having such self-critical, self-reflexive thoughts as she shopped set her apart from the other women, surely. So she still believed herself to be, however stealthily, an eccentric person not suited to conventions of thought or sensibility. Later, this desire to be contrary to convention had taken on a new urgency well beyond clothes or matters of taste. An unruly, even perverse inclination animated her. It had been looking for a place to land, for something to fasten on. So now, not before, this odd inner state pushed her toward a highly destabilizing wildness, a recklessness that she could suppress no longer.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to hear that read. Wayward opens with Sam purchasing a dilapidated historical home in downtown Syracuse to live in, apart from her husband and daughter. From there, the novel draws on architecture as a metaphor for bodies, families, cities, and communities. How did you decide upon a house as the functional heart of the novel?
My process is very much driven in a mysterious way, I think, by questions and intuition. And so I had walked by a house that inspired the house in the book. And it is dilapidated and boarded up and was once very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I wondered about it, and it just captivated me. And I had this idea of a woman falling in love with a house, and then only realizing after she'd made an offer on the house that she was going to leave her life and her husband. And the consequence of that appealed to me, and that's where I began, just this kind of rupture. And then following out the consequence of that rupture and then writing to discover why she did this thing was compelling to me. And her voice came out of that. And once I had her voice, then I was able to see who she was, understand who she was. It's so strange the way that works with writing. Mm-hmm. And her eccentricity is really that she has this, and many of my characters, I think, in my books do this, have a kind of obsession with something. And in this case, she loves architecture, and she notices architecture in a way that's very personal, so and almost tactile. So that, once I understood that about Sam, then that allowed that part of the book to have this architectural focus. And the metaphorical parts of that all make sense to me, but they were not something I began with, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it seems like you may have an interest in, the particular architectures that define certain cities. Was this house that you first saw, did it have a particular meaningfulness to how you thought about Syracuse as a place?
Yes. I mean, I think that there are a lot of the prosperous time in Syracuse, where a lot of the domestic architecture was built, was during the arts and what we call the arts and crafts era. And the arts and crafts era is interesting because it has this, this philosophical idealism behind it, and came out of, critiquing the 19th century that kind of industrialization and wanting to have getting back to some more hands-on authenticity. And then, of course, it just became a style, that rich people wanted. So I'm very attracted to these kinds of paradoxes, the way that something that can start in a realm of idealism and then become corrupted and ruined, but still have elements of that idealism in it. Then that's kind of the beauty of it, is that once something is beautiful, it also means that it can be kind of corrupted too. So I find that compelling about that particular era, that that those houses are so enduring because they are built to such intense relationship to material, so that they hold up very well. And I like this idea as I was progressing in the book. And again, a lot of this stuff only comes out as you're working. You're like, oh, why am I writing about this? Oh, maybe it's because of that. That these houses existed before Sam was born, and they will outlive her. And so these mortal questions became, I think the book starts in a register of satire, and it moves to a more emotional, mortal register as it closes. And so that became the arc of the book for me, I think, in some way.
So this is a novel deeply concerned with a woman's autonomy, namely in a time of putative freedom for American women. What are the parameters for how a woman is allowed to make decisions about her own life? You dramatize this with Sam's decision to live apart from the family that she loves, while brilliantly contrasting this radical autonomy with Sam's desire to have some control over the life of her daughter and the death of her mother. Do you feel like this is a defining feature of our lives, the struggle between a need to control and a desire to be our own person?
That's so astute, and I think absolutely, yes, because, and I think that's partially why menopause is such a big part of the book, that the number one thing that you can't control is your body.
Yeah.
The terms are set for all of us, right? And you can wiggle around and turn with it a little bit, but ultimately I'll end up in the same place. And so, I do think being able to understand that, you cannot control so much, which also does not let you off the hook for, being responsible for what you can control, that tension is very much a feature of midlife. And I think menopause, For the people that experience those symptoms, it's a very dramatic reminder that our lives are finite and that we can't control our bodies, and that's humbling. But I think it also leads to a kind of wisdom because the world will go on without you, and maybe that's okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're not the center of the universe, and so I think it's particular to women that. There's a part of the novel that's very interested in how women are both colluding in the state of things and complicit with a lot of the state of things, but they're also at the same time subjugated, and so to be a woman in contemporary society is to feel yourself pulled in these different directions, at least a kind of privileged white woman like Sam. And so she is both. So I think her gesture of upending her comfort and putting herself in a deliberately discomforting place is both a supreme act of privilege, but also I think a kind of brave move at the same time. Yeah. I think she's trying to have some clarity about where she is and who she is. And taking a kind of, and reckoning with it, and she may be, and that has consequences. I mean, it estranges her further from her daughter, but
absolutely.
Ultimately maybe that's a good thing, you know?
Mm. Mm-hmm. I, as you were saying it, I was thinking that it's interesting that so much time is spent with men's midlife crises, when women have this very discreet biological marker of the midlife where the body kind of shouts at you in this way that I think is kind of fundamentally different. And you dramatize that so well with this idea of the sort of like middle of the night wake up where you can't get back to sleep and you're forced to confront all these things. And I would think that we should have lots and lots of narratives of women's midlife crises brought on by these like fundamental announcements of the body. But it's strange that it's the other way around.
Well, I think that it's it The reason why is because there is still, despite all the progress that you refer to about women have made, it is still shameful to admit that you're aging, particularly as a woman, I suppose, for all people. But it is, and I think that when the midlife crisis has been portrayed, I was thinking about it in films and television shows as well as in books, it's often about, you know, that I'm no longer, I'm become invisible to men, or I've become less desirable. Mm-hmm. I'm aging in this way. And so I'm going to have an affair with a young man, or I'm going to be left by my husband for a younger woman. And I have to figure out what to do with myself. And I did really was very conscious of working against that. And I really wanted Sam to not be so interested in those. I didn't want her to have an affair. I didn't want her to want to look young again. Mm-hmm. You know, I think those are kind of trivial depictions of what midlife is about. I think so that was quite deliberate. And I think that is kind of and that's why I think Sam is so drawn to these women that embrace their aging in this aggressive way.
I think that's right.
That's appealing to her, that they are in your face about their aging and their refusal to capitulate into sort of being ashamed of it. Mm-hmm. But of course, those women are hypocritical and full of contradiction, like all of the people in the book. So it's not so simple. I mean, you know, this MH charismatic kind of culty figure that she gets involved with is actually kind of quite glamorous. She's not really grotesque at all. So
yeah. And her genes that are meant to signal like just a kind of disregard for fashion are noted as like $300, like super fashionable, right? And, you know, very purposeful in the kind of image that she wants to produce.
Yeah. So I think that was, you know, that tension between surface and reality, and constantly, characters are constantly thinking they know who they are, and then it turns out they're not. There is another layer of hypocrisy underneath it, or another layer of self-delusion. And I think Sam is desperate to not be self-deluded. And of course, that's impossible. I mean, we live as humans by layers of self-delusion. and it's paralyzing to eliminate all that. But I think it's important from time to time to have these foundational questioning moments where you do try to have clarity about who you really are and what you really represent. And even if you can't stay there forever,
there's a wonderful switcheroo in the narrative voice, where just when we're sort of comfortable with and wound up with Sam's direction of the narrative, Allie shows up as the voice that gets to speak about the world. And it's at this point that we understand that Allie desires the same kind of bodily and emotional independence that her mother has been seeking, while trying her best to deny it for Allie. Did you mean that to be a surprise shift? I was pleasingly shocked by it.
Yes, I mean, it came that way for me as an author as well, because I am first envisioned the book as being all told from Sam's very subjective point of view. Even though it's third person, it's very close to her consciousness throughout her sections. And that became... that felt too narrow to me as I was writing. And I thought, well, you know, what if there was a scene that we saw from Sam's point of view, and then we see it from her daughter's point of view. And so I started to write Allie. And once I had done that, I saw this whole other plot came into the book of what Allie was up to and what her secrets were and what she wanted and her autonomy and her vision of things, and it became a strong counter. And then the irony that came out as I was writing is that Allie is trying so hard to separate, and she's ultimately, I think, not that different from her mother, even though in a superficial way, she seems very different. They have a lot of the same values and eccentricities, but mm-hmm. they need space from one another. And this is, a struggle, I think, for both of them. And I think a lot of what Allie does is reactive, which is not what you want. You want right. it to come out of what you really desire. But I do think she has, so that voice became very, very important. And I think one of the great things about fiction and novels and art is that we as readers can see more than the characters, and we can mm-hmm. see these ironies, and we can see these connections that we can't in our own lives because we're so stuck in our own subjectivity. So you can have that sense of realism of what it's like to be in a character's mind, but also get this broader view. And so that really becomes, I think, a great energy in a novel.
Yeah, I love that they're both narrative voices are circling this same contradiction about a life where you need, to be yourself, even when that means making mistakes, and also a need for others to support and imbue you with meaning. And they're both very much on the same kind of quest, but we watch as they circle it and can't, they stick a toe in it but can't quite get there. And the way that propels the narrative is quite wonderful. And as you say, our readerly perspective to that irony is really important. The impetus for Sam's move to this house is the election of Donald Trump. An astonishing number of books that I've read in the past 2 years have been set immediately post the 2016 election. It has made my experience of the novel one of hyper-contemporaneity, as though authors were speeding to grab up the political events of the moment to make their books feel more alive. Why do you think our former petty tyrant has been a catalyst for so much fiction?
Well, I think that I can only speak for myself, but I think that, if you want to write about what it's like to be alive now, it's really, you have to talk about the political situation. And the big rupture was the Trump election. And it's like writing a novel about now without writing about technology. As much as you don't want to talk about it, you must. You have to grapple with it because the characters, realistically, unless they're completely clueless, would be affected by it. Having said that, I do think that it's only one contributing factor to her husband thinks that's what really is the catalyst. Mm-hmm. But I think Sam sees it as multivalent. I mean, she sees her mother's prognosis, her mother's revelation that she's dying, I think is a big factor that Sam feels very ill prepared for what's to come and realizes that she needs to change if she's going to cope, if she's going to accept that there's this horrifying feeling in midlife where you realize that what's to come is much harder than what came before. and she's very nostalgic for when her daughter was young and her mother, and she could be with her mother and her daughter in this uncomplicated way, and that doesn't last. And that's the job maybe of all this extra life. I mean, one of the questions that keeps coming up is what do you do with this extra life? Meaning, the part after the first 50 years, the second whatever to come, postmenopausal, and what's the, is it enough to just see yourself, or is there something else that needs to be done with all you've been given? Those are really important, I think, moral questions and identity
Absolutely.
Questions.
Wayward is really the best thing I've read about motherhood since Helen Phillips' The Need. Hers is a horror story about the impossibly profound love between a mother and a child, and yours is a complicated love story about that bond. Sam leaves the house where Allie lives and wants nothing more than to be closer to her. Why do you think this push and pull between parent and child is so fundamental to the adult lives of those who have children?
Well, it's complicated. And I don't have any answers. I wanted to just describe the complication, I think. I think part of it is that having written it and also experiencing it somewhat, is that I think that you can have this very precious focus on your own child, and the world is full of children, and you can lose your perspective. And I think that's partially why Sam is so gets so angry about the college application project that her daughter's going to, because it feels having all this good energy devoted on just one person is not only wrong, given how many people in the world need things, but also not good for the child, you know, not good for the human that you're trying to help make their way in the world, to just try to that over-parenting, that overbearingness, that trying to give them everything and protect them from making any mistake is bad parenting. And I think that Sam leaving, in some sense, on some deep level, she knows that that's also a good thing for her daughter, to give her daughter space, even though emotionally she wants to hold her so tightly. And I think that that's partially because being a parent is such, it's an experience of love that I think you think you understand before it happens, that it must be equivalent. A mother loving a daughter is equivalent to how you feel about your own mother. You love your mother, and you love your daughter. But it turns out actually that the parenting part of it is much more intense, at least from my experience, and from what Sam feels in the book, that it's very seductive because it feels selfless, right? Mm-hmm. When you love your child, you feel that it's great to get it. You escape yourself in some way because you're taking care of someone else. But there's a kind of narcissism to it as well, because it's such a narrow focus. And so I was very interested in all the complications of contemporary middle-class motherhood, I guess is what I would say.
There's a beautiful and complicated scene when Sam is at the gym and she goes to the showers and she sees an adult woman with her adult daughter, who she surmises may have Down syndrome, and they're in the shower together, and she's helping her daughter to shower, and they are delighted with each other, and there's an ease with each other's bodies, and a physical connection between an adult daughter and a woman past that sort of midpoint in her life that Sam realizes she will probably never have again. But it's complicated because it's not said directly, but of course she understands that the difficulties of this particular kind of dependency are incredible and something much different than she has with Allie. But I was wondering what were you thinking when you wrote that scene?
Well, it has that, I think it reminds Sam of the bodily intimacy you have, that it's so particular and it exists in no other place in your life, and it's fleeting, where you feel so intimate with someone in a non-sexual way, right? And I think that that's a revelation in motherhood, is that you can feel this intense bodily intimacy in a non-sexual context. And sexuality is a very complicated subject. Is something they fight about when Allie goes to the mall as a 14-year-old, and the dangers of her not realizing what the world is and how the world will view her, and Sam not knowing how much to protect or repress or to frighten her daughter about the power and the subjugation of being a sex object in the world. Mm-hmm. And so those are all complicated issues, but there is this incredible, when you have a young child, I think whether you're a father or a mother, where you just appreciate the beauty and the voluptuous quality of affection that you get with small children that is divorced from sexuality. And at least in American culture, it doesn't get replicated in any other you don't find that anywhere in any other relationship, really.
That's true. Yeah. So in thinking about the various things that I think distinguish your novel and signify for me that it is a work of literary fiction is the way in which you deal with what would be the potential villains of the novel, and that you really refuse to satisfy our base readerly instinct for the easy villains. Joe, the older man who takes up with Allie, you know, would be ripe for your demonization, and we would probably enjoy it as readers. But even that relationship is one where Joe is sort of subtly pushing Allie to reconnect with her mother. Mark, Sam's estranged husband, is remarkably kind and understanding, upending pretty much every other such husband in literature. Is this something that you think that literary fiction can do well, and does it happen, you know, more than I think it does?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are seldom all good or all bad in real life, and I think that we kind of lose track of that sometimes because, you know, the way we engage with the world is very fast and in a shallow way, you know, mostly through social media, it seems, in which, you know, things are rendered in black and white terms and good and bad. And I do think that fiction is a place where that doesn't happen, you know, that you can still condemn what Joe has done and see him as doing bad things. I mean, he's, you know, a libertarian and a developer with full of hypocrisy, and he's doing this, you know, illegal and inappropriate relationship. But he is appealing to Allie. You know, Allie likes him, likes sleeping with him. She grows to dislike him. But, you know, she does it on her own terms. And so it doesn't, I didn't want the agency to be on him. I didn't want it to be about Joe, simply as a predator, but I wanted it to be, you know, that he's this, you know, kind of ordinary bad guy in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And he has terrible taste in renovation and, you know, and she kind of condemns him aesthetically before she condemns him morally, only when, you know, and then he ends up breaking up with her when, you know, she has the impulse to push away from him, but she's still sexually attracted to him, so she doesn't quite do it. So it's really, you know, and in terms of, so I think Joe is probably Joe and M.H., the woman who's also a kind of predator in the book, they're both the bad guys, but at the same time, they say things that are true, and they are, as bad guys often do. So it's not that I don't think there are people who are doing bad things and deserve to be condemned and punished for those things, but I also think they seldom. The reason why they're dangerous is because they have parts. They have a story they tell themselves of what they're doing, where they're not bad, right? Mm-hmm. Where they understand themselves to be doing something appropriate. And I think in a weird kind of way, I think M.H. is probably the darkest character in the, and maybe John Humphrey Noyes also seems pretty dark in the book too.
Right.
although complicated, in that he's, you know, he's got a predatory relationship with young women in his community. He's the all-powerful male in this you know, subculture he's created, but he also believes what he's doing. You know, he believes he's righteous and is persuasive in many ways. So, yeah, that's an interesting place to be, I think, for fiction. And the husband, you know, I didn't want it to be that she had a terrible marriage. So we were, you know, of course she should leave, because that seems cliche and what's to discover there.
Yeah.
But yeah. What if you need to leave and it isn't a terrible relationship?
Yeah.
You know? And so she backslides and starts sleeping with him again. And she keeps him in her life. She just doesn't want to live with him anymore, you know, because she needs her own space. So, so it's letting it be as complicated as it needs to be. And there's a part of me that understood that when Sam doesn't, turn on, you know, when she finds out about Joe in the end of the book, and she doesn't react the way she would have. I think some readers might be disappointed that she doesn't, you know, punch him in the face or something. She just kind of walks away and lets her daughter do what she has to do. And I think that the dark forces in the book become more systemic, you know, the poverty and the inequity of the city, and the injustice that is much a part of our lives, whether you look at them or not, and the kind of small and big contradictions that we live with. To me, those are the dark forces in the book.
Yeah, and the idea of making that, in particular, the men who are some of the villains here, making them minor when they see themselves as major, and allowing those systematic things to rise up and to moving the kind of individual badness out of the kind of center of the novel's heart, I think is a wonderful and different kind of way to treat people who do bad things. And it was really clear in the novel how valuable that was. And especially, you know, Sam's decision not to punch him in the face at the fair is probably a fundamental piece of what allows her to come back together with her daughter. And that's even though you sort of want that punch to come, you realize how important it was that she didn't do that. You pay a lot of attention to our frantic attempts as humans to stop the aging clock. Almost everyone in Wayward is measuring their biometrics in some fashion. They pay an excessive amount of attention to the chemical processes of their body, whether it is via dietary exclusion, weightlifting, or the use of technology to monitor their bodies. Sam has an obsession with young men who seek to treat their bodies as machines capable of defying time. There's empowerment in Sam's own attempts to be stronger physically, but is that empowerment ultimately secondary to what you call the terror and shame of our aging bodies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's very smart. I just, she wants to be strong, but she also sees the narcissism in that attention to the self, right? And that feels very problematic to her, even as she feels the need to do it, participate in it. And I think that is that is something that I can certainly relate to. You know, that kind of push and pull of how much you cherish your own body in the face of you know, one, that you're still not going to escape the terms no matter what. And two, that you know, there are people actually starving while you're, you know, dieting. So it's there's something really intensely contradictory in those gestures and those obsessions. And I also just noticed this in that one section where she's with her Nico, the weightlifter, and she's kind of making, you know, Sam makes fun of a lot of people, including herself. And I think that's her saving grace, is that she makes a lot of jokes. And she kind of and is quite, she's judgmental, but she's harshest on herself, I think. But she sees this, this focus on the self and self-care. It did irritate me how much people talk about self-care all the time. So I had to put it in the book. I found there's something so wrong about it, really. I understand the impulse is that, you know, we're especially as women, you're sort of drawn to be self-sacrificing and putting everyone else before you, especially if you're a mother, right? And so the impulse is to go the opposite way and say we got to take care of self, but that also doesn't work.
Do you find it to be a kind of leftover from the capitalist imperative to turn your body into a kind of cog where there's never any stop of the workday? It bleeds over into everything. And so there's this weird kind of mantra about self-care, which really does very little to care for the self while causing you to then ignore the needs of those in much more dire situations.
Absolutely. I think you've put it very well. And I think that it is work too, right? So it does feel very American. It does feel like American capitalism.
You've got to work on it.
And it's work that costs money, right? So it is all of those. It's essentially turning yourself into the ultimate consumer, you know, object that never is finished, right? So that's something that has to be interrogated, at the least, right?
Yeah, and just thinking about the money side of it, half of the things that social media advertises to me are about supposed self-care, but it is an extraordinary expense if one were to go down that road. I love the sort of way that the house and the body in this novel are standing in for one another, and that the ways in which the body kind of shows itself as beautiful, and even in its aging, comes up again and again with Sam's relationship to the house. And there are two moments in the novel that I just wanted to flag because I find them beautiful in their own way. And one is from Clara, her letters, which exist in the novel, in which she's talking about her young body. And she says, "What a thing this body is. What discoveries will I make with it?" And then it's paralleled nicely with this moment where Sam is sort of gradually understanding that as hard as she will try, her body is out of her control. What a thing, this out of control body. It made her aware of how her body was alien to her, progressing toward its decline, its next phase, regardless of her desire or collusion. Her participation was not required. Both of these are true about the body at every stage, even older bodies, that they are full of vast potential, and that all bodies are moving through these phases of life, whether we want them to or not. Do you think it's ever possible to be content with these paradoxical notions of the body?
Oh, that's so beautifully connected. Thank you for that. Yes, I do think that there are moments of peace where you can accept all of those contradictions and celebrate. And maybe that's the answer to this kind of self-care thing. Maybe the better way to think about it is a celebration of inhabiting a body with its flaws and with its aging and with its potential. And I think I love that you read that moment from Clara, because I think she becomes another person in the book that we haven't heard from directly. We've just heard about, and we've seen her externally. And I think, and I hope that it becomes kind of shocking to sort of see her. And again, this idea of idealism before it's corrupted, where, and, you know, she becomes this really problematic figure. Like a lot of women that were interested in reproductive rights also kind of veered into eugenics at certain points. Mm-hmm. And again, it's one of those things where I'm very attracted to these contradictory, paradoxical, both idealism mixed with, you know, this darker thing that comes out of it. And maybe that's a good way of thinking about our bodies too. Our bodies are both this place of idealism and experience that's both pure and accessible at any moment, but also a place of shame and a place mm-hmm. where we experience our reminders of our death and the fact that we have no control ultimately. So so much of this book exists on the plane of the body and keeps returning to the body. And I think that's partially why the blood that you spoke of comes out, because even beyond Sam's consciousness, her body is still there, you know, doing its thing, whether it's bleeding out into the floor mm-hmm. or, you know, she imagines that she's someone is after her and has hit her. But in fact, it's just her own body that's really attacking her at this point. And getting back to this thing that goes through the whole novel, which is this insomnia. And there's something about insomnia in particular, which hers is driven by her hormones, but we all experience insomnia as this weird moment where you're both, your body is supposed to be able to do the one of the basic functions of your body has gone haywire, right? You're supposed to be, sleeping should not be complicated, right? And if you look at a child, it isn't. Mm-hmm. And somehow how we live our lives has made our bodily functions become something we're conscious of. And then we needlessly complicate it, or maybe needfully complicate it. And then we don't even know how to be a body anymore. So that's just then you feel that you need to find some reconciliation, some peace. And so partially, I think it is accepting. Maybe the problem with insomnia is that you cast it as a problem. Maybe it's not a problem. Maybe it's just your body.
Yeah, that's the way you put that, the idea of understanding that your body is a body and that you exist within it and that it has these processes that we come to then kind of layer on to these anxieties about them, whereas they are the body is acting out its purpose in various ways. And we, you know, time and again in the novel, Sam comes to these realizations that, you know, the being up in the middle of the night has allowed her to think about things that the rush of the day may have been hidden from her prior to this. And that, in fact, that's something to be grateful for, even though she's so afeared of everything that comes along with this idea of the change that is making her sort of see her body as dysfunctional or decrepit or aging. But it, in fact, imbues upon her this time that, even though it's anxiety provoking, is time to think and to be. And I really, I appreciated that about it. I wanted to think a little bit about Syracuse in the novel. You live and work there, and the novel is very interested in the history of what gets called the Salt City and the Emerald City. It's a city that gets a chance to speak for herself through a pamphlet that we read at the end of the novel. And Sam's relationship to the city is learning to love something that feels and looks unlovable. All the great historical houses seem to sit empty in the city center. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your relationship to Syracuse.
Yes. Syracuse is I think many places are interesting if you look closely at them. And a small city in 2017 seemed, you know, an interesting place to focus rather than New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco, the places that usually seem to be the center of the culture. So yes, decentering the usual cities and taking this, homely, one where prosperity has moved on. There are so many cities like that in the United States. And thinking and kind of looking at it as it reveals its beauty and its decrepitude and its, you know, the ironies it has too, just like the body, where what used to be the Erie Canal is just a, you know, arterial commercial road that has all the box stores on it now, James Street that used to have all these beautiful houses when Clara Loomis's era, and now is, you know, just kind of been built over in a haphazard way. So yeah, I find it an interesting place where the more you are attuned to the history, and Syracuse has such an interesting history, which is why the 19th century part of the book is important. You know, that the women's movement and the abolition movement, mm-hmm. and all of those 19th century reform movements, so much of it happened in this area because of the Erie Canal and because it was centrally located, and that sometimes feels forgotten or not appreciated. There is in the way that it ought to be. And then Syracuse, in its present state, is one of the things about a small city is you can't really hide from the inequity. I mean, you go block by block, and you have these beautiful, well-kept houses next to boarded up houses. And, and it's a vibrant, alive place. There's a long history of accepting refugees here, and that's still the case. And it's part of the vitality of the city. But there's also, systemically oppressed sections of the city. The 15th Ward, which was the historically black section, got wiped out for I-81. And now, and there's just parking lots where there used to be neighborhoods, or worse, empty lots. And so it's a city that still has a lot of vitality and potential and beauty. And it has this kind of American post-prosperity sadness to it that is very compelling to me. I think being in fiction, it's important to be really specific and local if you want to talk about bigger things. So the specificity of just, if it's going to take place in Syracuse, it's really going to take place in Syracuse, mm-hmm. And I had to quell the part of myself that says, no one wants to read about Syracuse. You know what? It's going to be interesting because it's going to be, it's so full of life and contradiction, just like the house, right? Mm-hmm. That she writes about, and just like the body that she writes about, because who wants to read about middle-aged women with menopause? Nobody, right? But, maybe it's interesting if you just attend it.
And I was so pleased to read about Syracuse. It's a city very close to where I live, but about which I know almost nothing. And I feel like it doesn't get to feature in fiction and film very often, but it does have this deeply interesting historical past. And I was so glad to see all of it in its complicated inequity on display in this novel, and similarly pleased to read about a woman in a menopausal moment. But in any case, reading about women at that time in their lives was both a refreshing change, but also really welcome. Can we talk for a second about the beauty of your book as a material object? It has this wonderful spectrum of pink, red, and yellow with the simple house keys dangling from the book title. But it's also, it's a very tall, sort of narrow book. And it feels like it has stature to it, like, a structure that's uncommon to novels that I tend to hold in my hand. Did you have a lot of input in the design and format of the book? And what's your feeling about physical versus electronic books?
Well, I think I do think it's a really compelling object, and to have it in your hands really puts you in the right state of mind to read the book, which doesn't always happen. So I'm very pleased that you feel that way, because I feel that way too. The narrow trim, right? It's a little bit more narrow and tall than the hardcover books usually are. And some people have said to me that it looks like a door.
I like that.
House,
yeah.
Which I think
is very nice.
And then if you look on the spine, there's the colophon for Knopf, which is the board guy, has a little key on it. It's just a beautifully, and I love the typeface too. Mm-hmm. And I did get to have, the designers, came up with all of this, but I got to say yes or no to it. And but this was the one, you know, there was a slight variation on this that we changed slightly, but really just the type was switched. My name was in the kind of handwritten, kind of Sharpie written, and the title was in the type, and we switched that around or something like that. Mm-hmm. But other than that, this was the way they came up with it. And I also think the type within the book is really important because there are so many different formats, right? Everything from, internet comments and letters and pamphlets and having that, this it kind of somewhat arts and crafts related style, mm-hmm. you know, that they're the typeface, I think, and the design of the interior of the book is really a big part of it too. And I think it is really, since it's a book about the body, I like that this is the body of the book. Mm-hmm. So it feels like you have a physical relationship to it. And I like that. And I think about that a lot with technology. I mean, a book is just, a physical book is technology too. It's outdated old technology.
Oh, that's right.
When I think about tech, when I write about tech, I'm always thinking the reason why I have it in my book is because it's part of how we live now and it shapes us so profoundly. But when I want to write about it, I always think about the two things. One is, what does it feel like on your body to engage with this technology? You know, what does it feel like in your hand and when you swipe your phone or when you open a book? Getting it back to the body seems the place for me where interesting fiction happens, and it's something that fiction can do that other things can't do. And then the other part of it is, what does it feel like in your mind? Like, how does your consciousness interact with it? Mm-hmm. And so those two things, that tension, are the way that I... So I think of it as a superior technology to electronic in every way for me as a reader, mm-hmm. because it, you know, you're sitting in a chair with that physical object and that intimate relationship, and you can't click through and you're not distracted. And that seems more and more important as I feel the purgatory of getting into novels has become, and I'm an old person. I can't imagine what it's like for young people, but once you're in, it's the same experience, but getting in is more difficult because you just want to check your phone and you want to, you know, return for emails, and you have to sort of force yourself. And so the book allows you to do that. This old technology allows you to disconnect in a way that's necessary to get through the purgatory of getting into a book. And then once you're in, you feel the pull of, if it's a good book, you feel the pull of the book itself. So it's almost like books need to be physical now for you to really experience them. Having said that, I'm glad they're electronic books because I do like that you can search for things in electronic books in a way, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like you remember a word from earlier in the book and you can search for it and find it again. So it does enhance some aspects of reading. So I do like that, especially if I'm teaching a book. That seems really important.
I agree. I honestly, for me, sort of fiction can't even happen in electronic form, I think, because of exactly what you describe, the needed purgatory phase that we have to be in to truly kind of engage it. But I do like reading other things electronically for that searchability. But I almost, I can't let go of the fact that the antiquated technology of the physical book allows that separation, even if it means I have to like lock my phone somewhere in another room and give someone the key that isn't me. But speaking of the purgatory, we're recording in the last gasps of summer. What are the best things you've read in this strange, strange summer? And are there things you're looking forward to in the fall lineup of book releases?
Yes. I will expand a little bit past the summer because, if you allow me, the two books three books, I would say, one is, Katie Kitamura's Intimacies. Mm-hmm. I've read earlier in the year and then reread cause I had an event with her, and I love the book even more on the second read. I recommend that highly. And then Anthony So's collection of short stories, After Parties, I've read again. And he was a student at Syracuse University in our MFA program.
Oh my goodness.
And it's an extraordinary collection of stories. And I just love how it's political and it's pointed, but it's so funny, you know, and it's so full of life.
Death is so tragic, especially with that novel's just prominence now.
Yeah, that is terrible, terrible. But the book remains.
Yes,
you know?
It does.
And
yeah,
he lives in the book, and then All's Well by Mona Awad, which just came out. I love that book. Is another book that's so interested in the body in a totally different way. You know, it's got really kind of amazing magical conceit in Shakespeare, but it also has this about a woman experiencing like chronic invisible pain and being liberated from that. And I really love that book as well. And then I'm really looking forward to soon Harrow by Joy Williams, her first novel in, I don't know, maybe 15 years or something. And she's one of my favorite writers. And I haven't started it yet, but I think
she's principally a poet. Is that right?
No, a short story writer.
Short story writer. Okay.
Short story. And she's an amazing writer. And this is another kind of it's sort of from what I understand, as I haven't read it yet. It's very short, but it's a kind of post environmental apocalypse. And she is, you know, she's been a radical environmentalist forever, and writes about the animal world and the natural world like nobody else. And I think it's going to be a harrowing book, but I'm ready because her sentences are just amazing. So that's up next for me, Joy Williams.
That sounds fabulous. And Katie Kitamura was my guest a couple of episodes ago, and I agree with you entirely. That book is really, really tremendous, and I look forward to teaching it in future years as well.
Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dana, thank you so much. This has been such a lovely conversation, and I so adore this novel, and I hope that everyone will get a chance to hold the material thing itself, door, house, book, in their hand while they read it. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was wonderful.
Take care. My deepest thanks to Dana Spiota, whose novel Wayward is out now and calling to you from your local indie bookstore. There will be links to Dana's recommendations for late summer reading on the website at burnedbybooks.com. If you have a chance, please rate the show at iTunes or Spotify to bring new listeners into the fold. I am, as always, grateful for the time you spend with me thinking about the books we love. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.